Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Thursday, the 4th of July. Coming up on the program, a minority government in Gauteng. The DA cries foul. The ANC says, though, it's confident it will work. And also the fate of two South Africans currently held captive in Equatorial Guinea. Well, finally, the Gauteng Premier Pan Yazila Sufi has announced his cabinet after a fortnight of postponements due to deadlocked negotiations with the Democratic Alliance. Effectively, it's a minority government that has been formed with the Patriotic Alliance, the IFP, and Rise Mzansi. The DA is saying it pulled out of being part of government in the province because the ANC wanted to strong-arm it. Let's start our coverage with the Gauteng Premier Pan Yazila Sufi, who is with me. And first of all, Premier, is this really the outcome that you wanted?
I think it's a misleading statement that is a minority government. What we have here, we have a government that have political parties that have publicly endorsed the government of national unity. And we also have organizations that have not publicly endorsed but are willing to work with the ANC. And they've committed themselves to work with the ANC. If you exclude the DA that have decided not to work with the ANC in Gauteng, you've got 78% of political parties that have indicated one form of partnership and relationship with the ANC. And I'll give you an example. The Freedom Front say the DA didn't treat them well when they left them at Moonshot. And they feel they can work with the ANC. And they want to chair two committees as part of their signature of the Government of National Unity and Government of Provincial Unity. I doubt you've added their two seats in the numbers that you have just alluded to. You take Action SA. They want to remain an independent party, but they said to us, give us a committee to chair called SCOPA so that we can hold you accountable. If we are doing good, we will support you. If we feel that we're not doing good, we will oppose you. It's a 50-50 political party. They've got three seats. Did you add them? No. You go to MK Party. When they were voting for the speaker, they voted with us. Did you add them? No. And I can go on and on and on with ACDP and all other political parties that are not in the executive, but they want to work with the ANC. So what we have here, we have a delicate situation where we need to balance those that believe they can work with us in terms of the government of national unity. And we've demonstrated that by electing them in the executive. But there are those that want to work with the government of provincial unity, but they don't want positions in committees or they also don't want a position in the executive committee. And we said on an item or agenda basis, we'll be in a position to engage them. And hopefully they'll continue to support us, either when we pass the budget or when there is a motion of no confidence against the leadership of this government.
And that's going to take a lot of deft negotiation and discussion. Would it not have been better to have the DA within the PGU to give you more stability?
Let me start with the first part. It's not going to be delicate because already have some form of relationship with these parties. Take the EFF, for example. We have a political council that meets quarterly with them because we are running either Ekurhuleni or Mogale City, Johannesburg, and other municipalities. So it's not a delicate thing. We just have to sense each other and deal with the issues. The best option, obviously, is to go with the DA. I postponed the announcement of the cabinet twice to give this these negotiations an opportunity. It was humiliating. It was embarrassing. But the cries of bringing DA was very important. Besides, we're working with them at national. It was not going to be difficult to work them at the province. And the differences were minimum, if I have to say. it was just a difference of one MEC position that we're prepared to engage. When we deadlocked at the provincial level, we said, let's go to our national leadership to assist us to unblock this deadlock. We then left the meeting to say, we're going to consult our national leadership after the final proposal that was put on the table by the DA. Before we can come back to respond to the proposal that the DA has put on the table, the DA left the negotiations, called a press conference hurriedly, and denounced the negotiations and said there's a deadlock. Regardless of that statement that they held in the press conference, our SG wrote them a letter to say, come back to the negotiation table, we still have 2 o'clock the following day to come back to the negotiations. They didn't come back. We extended that deadline from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock. They didn't come back. It was on that basis that government can't be kept waiting. Budget need to be passed for teachers to be paid. Budget need to be passed for patients to get food and medication. You can't hold government at ransom for that long. Hence the route that we've taken. But the door is still open. And I still feel that we need to persuade the DA to come on board and resolve the issues that need to be resolved.
So, two questions then. How would you describe your current relationship with the Democratic Alliance, given that the party says you tried to strong-arm it and negotiate in bad faith?
We didn't strong-arm it. The reason why I'm the premier today is a document that the DA developed. That document said, we'll support you as a premier, we'll support an ANC candidate as a speaker, we'll support, you must support us as a deputy speaker, and you must support us as chair of chairs and give us 3 MECs. As I'm speaking to you now, the offer of 3 MECs still stands. So we didn't armstrong them. We didn't mislead them. We kept to the document that the DA drafted and handed over to us to lead to the process of electing the premier, to lead the process of electing a speaker. There was no way the DA can just vote for a premier without an agreement. The only problem became, after electing the premier and the speaker and the deputy speaker, the DA came the following day when we wanted them to give us the 3 names of the MECs that we want to pronounce or the 3 portfolios that we want to allocate to them. They say that document no longer have a local standing and they're withdrawing that document. That the confusion, that was the beginning of the confusion that led to where we are today. If that document that they drafted and handed over to us stood, will not be where we are. And that's the reason why we still feel we can still go back and engage on those matters.
I just want to ask you one procedural question, if I can, in terms of the new setup. You've moved community safety into your office. Why have you done that, and how are you going to ensure that this reorganization actually leads to tangible results?
Read the crime statistics. Which province have the highest criminal activities? Gauteng. Read the crime stats. How many people are killed, kidnapped in Gauteng? How many cars are hijacked? How many women are raped? How many children are killed? And we still believe that we can use the normal processes of fighting crime. We have done that in the last 15 years. It didn't yield the results that we need. I honestly believe if there's something this government needs to prioritize, is the fight against crime. You'll never attract investment in a violent crime, a province that you are in. We'll never attract families that you want to make their children or grow their children and ensure that their children have better education in our province, because anything can happen to their children. They can be killed. They can be kidnapped. You will never attract huge institutions to come and relocate their headquarters to Gauteng because of the high level of crime. You go to all the CBDs that we have in Gauteng. All of them have collapsed, from Springs to Roodepoort. You go to Johannesburg. I really believe that unless you prioritize, put the resources, put the skills and talent that is needed to fight crime in this province, we are not going to do it. And we are not going to succeed. And I really believe I'm ready to take that responsibility. To be a premier is one thing. I think the priority that I'm going to have in this administration is to tackle crime head on and lead that fight personally.
I am going to leave it there, Gauteng Premier Pan Yazala Sufi. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
So as you've heard, the Democratic Alliance saying it will not form part of Panyaza Lesufi's cabinet following a failure to reach an agreement with the ANC. The DA saying that it is not satisfied with the ANC's offer, insisting that it is unreasonable and unfair. Solium Simanga is the DA leader in the province. He had agreed to talk to us and has since decided to not pursue the interview. The offer, though, is still open. So do we have a degree of political stalemate in the province, essentially the country's economic powerhouse? I want to bring you some expert analysis now from Dr. Tokozani Chilenga Butau, who's a lecturer in political studies at Fitz University's specific expertise in the decentralization of government, in other words, powers between national, provincial and local spheres. Dr. Chilenga Butau, good afternoon to you and a very warm welcome. So we have parties in the new cabinet here in Gauteng only accounting for 33 of the legislature's 80 seats after talks, as you've just heard, between the ANC and the DA have deadlocked. Do you believe that this setup can work in the medium to long term?
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. I don't think that this would work in the medium to long term, simply because there are positions that we need to have election for in the provincial legislature. But also, it means that the province is not fully represented according to the election results that we've just had. There also seems to be some sort of disagreement between national structures of the ANC and provincial structures of the ANC, where at the national level, the ANC has constituted a government of national unity, showing that it is willing to work with other parties, no matter the party and the amount of difference in ideology or policy. Whereas at the provincial level, we find that the ANC is just going ahead and making announcements without trying to negotiate further until all seats and positions are filled and that represent the votes of the province.
Do you think then this is simply gamesmanship as far as the ANC is concerned?
To one extent, yes. And we saw this, when Johannesburg Metropolitan Councils collapsed quite a few times under coalition governments. At that time, which I think the latest time was about a year ago or so, the ANC was not forthcoming about the reasons for why, some of the coalition agreements had collapsed. And in this case, we haven't even gotten to the policy-making aspect or the policy implementation aspect in the province. There has been a collapse of agreement at just the position level, the MEC level, and choosing different positions. So this doesn't bode well for the province, because if they cannot agree at that level which positions will be taken by different parties, what does that mean for governance in the province going forward for the next 4 or 5 years?
Well, would you like to hazard a guess as to what the climate might be then? You rightly say that the province is not fully represented in the legislature. Are we going to see a bickering and deadlock?
Definitely bickering, less deadlock, because the ANC has gone ahead and filled the positions that it wants to, which doesn't show, trying to create a consensus position within the provincial legislature. But definitely bickering, fighting, a lot of contestation, and again, contestation over positions, whereas there are quite a few policy issues within the province that I'm sure a lot of residents are concerned about. So I listened to the, tail end of your interview with Premier Lesufi, and he talks about safety, being taken into his office. That is a serious policy issue, and you cannot just say, well, I'm going to take that into my office and deal with it, when you did not get 50+1%. What about residents who were persuaded by other political parties about what they would do about safety in the province and would prefer to have a different MEC in that position? So the knock-on effects will definitely continue to shake up the province until we have a fully constituted executive at that level.
The Premier also telling me that as far as the Democratic Alliance is concerned, the door is still open. So if he is making a fairly opaque offer like that, is the ball back in the DA's court?
Not necessarily. I mean, on one level, as an opposition party or as a party that got, you know, the next highest number in votes, you do have to keep coming back to the party that got the highest number of votes. But the onus is also on the ANC in this case to say, look, let's keep negotiating until we get to a position that we are satisfied with. It is not to say we're going to just announce the executive team or certain positions, regardless of what you think. So the infighting really needs to stop. Cool heads and logic need to prevail. And quite frankly, you know, the votes and the results of this election need to be respected because Gauteng has spoken.
What kind of pressure do you think this puts on the smaller parties within this fairly fragile coalition then?
So smaller parties that have been taken into the fragile coalition might, you know, choose to side with the ANC on certain matters or might feel the freedom to hold them accountable because they are within, you know, the executive that has been announced. On the other hand, there might be some negotiation and politicking going on behind closed doors with smaller parties and possibly the DA. And as I say, this is just a possibility, it's speculation, where, you know, they now proceed to say, what is the next course of action? What is available to us legally or constitutionally for us to constitute some sort of bloc or, you know, coalition amongst ourselves and go forward in the provincial legislature and sort out the issue of seats? I imagine that could be the next step for smaller parties, as well as the DA speaking to smaller parties.
Can we trace this all back to the statement of intent and perhaps the DA and the African National Congress having a different interpretation of it? And if that is correct, do you think the statement of intent was badly written?
You know, it could be that the statement of intent was badly written. And remember, political parties will have different interpretations of a lot of things that are presented before them or that they present to each other. But the point is to say, if we disagree with the statement of intent, what can be changed, what can be amended, what can be realigned so that we reach a point of consensus? So there's still time, in my view, to say if you're unhappy, as a political party with the statement of intent, can the door be reopened for renegotiation and trying to figure out what is wrong with the clauses in that statement and how we proceed, you know, in a fair manner?
So the ANC's Secretary General, Fikile Mbalula, and I'm just trying to find the statement that he made a little earlier, essentially saying that talks are deadlocked even after the intervention of the party's national office bearers. Can national government do anything more in this respect, do you think?
From a political party level, I think so. I think that the political parties being the DA and the ANC, you know, their internal structures right up to the national level can try to intervene. That is one step that can be taken. And I think Fikile Mbalula's statement reflects that there has been an intervention from the party at that level. On the other hand, which is not something that I think residents of Gauteng want, the national government could push to put Gauteng under administration until these issues are sorted out. That's a very extreme measure, and there are very specific reasons for it. Those reasons, I don't think, would are applicable in this case where positions are still being fought over, but that would be the extreme scenario.
Dr. Tokozani Chilenga Butau is a lecturer in political studies at Wits University. Thank you so much for your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Well, let's move now from politics to the environment, and an alien beetle that destroys trees has been detected in the Nelson Mandela Metro. I'm in conversation now with Malusi Mdoda, who is the head of parks and cemeteries in the Metro. And first of all, can you explain the significance of this discovery and perhaps the potential impact on the local environment?
Thanks for the question. We are very worried. We're proud of ourselves, of our environment and protection of our trees. So the discovery of this beetle in the Metro has raised a serious alarm. I mean, we've heard about its infestation in Adam Municipality, which started back in KZN, Peter Maris, back in 2017. And I believe most of the bigger metros have discovered this impact, like your city of Johannesburg, your city of Cape Town. They've made some interventions. So it was the first time for us in the Metro to discover the infestation of this beetle in the Metro. So it is very worrisome. As a result, we still to have quite a number of engagements to ensure that we find ways to minimize or even curb the spread of the beetle. But as it stands, we don't know, you know, what is an extent and how much invasion we have in the Metro. But we put in plans in place to ensure, you know, that we dispatch some of our horticulturists to be on the lookout. We also encourage residents, you know, to report any trees that they suspect that they might be infected.
Well, let's talk about that then. How can residents identify signs of infection?
It's quite a tricky beetle because it resides in the stem of the tree. It bores short holes in the tree, and then the very same holes are closed up with the dust from the wood. But the signs will show in the tree. It will have decaying leaves, starting losing the health of its tree. If it's an evergreen tree, it will start maybe losing some of the trees. And it will have those fungus type of wood that is growing on the stem. So those are all the signs of the beetle. It's very difficult to spot it with the naked eye until, you know, it has been identified through these signs. But what we will do as a Metro is to get the specialists in the field to probably run workshops with the communities so that people are aware exactly what is it that they must look for.
Are there specific short-term measures, though, that are being taken by the Nelson Mandela Metropole to prevent the spread? Is there anything that you can do in that respect?
Look, I think the least we can do is make an awareness first that there is such an infestation like this. And secondly, we encourage, because the only way this beetle can spread is through the movement of wood between cities or even towns, because the beetle itself resides in the stems of the tree. So all the wood traders, when they trade with their wood or even selling it, we encourage that they try to cover the wood and to ensure that there isn't much of a spread, because it's not like it can be blown away by wind and all that. You know, it needs to be moved physically.
What is the consequence if the spread is not contained?
Look, the consequence would be that eventually we will lose our foliage. We will lose quite most of these trees because eventually the trees end up dying. And besides that, if it affects a certain tree, chances are the tree is going to decay. And in terms of storms, strong winds, those trees might fall in people's property, which will be also a liability to the municipality, because eventually we will then be subjected to public claims. So the most worrying factor is for us to lose our forestation, where we're losing trees because of this beetle.
I'm assuming that the Metro authorities would be talking to your counterparts in Pietermaritzburg, for instance. We know that in 2017, that was the initial detection site of this shot hole borer beetle. Have you been in touch with them? If so, what are they telling you?
And of course, there's a lot of engagements that still needs to take place. Obviously, we need to discuss some of the issues internally and seek advice, you know, on the municipalities that have had the first hand of this infestation also, you know, to involve all the civil societies, interested and affected parties, because the reality is that it's an insect, you know. So there are entomologists out there that are specializing in this kind of studies. So we need to bring everyone on board so that we can shape a way forward.
I am going to leave it there. Malusi Mdoda, thank you very much indeed, Head of Parks and Cemeteries at the Nelson Mandela Bay Metro.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention has issued, reports the Daily Maverick, a formal opinion that the detention of Frederick Potgieter, he's a 54-year-old South African citizen, and Peter Huxham, a 55-year-old dual SA UK citizen in Equatorial Guinea, is both arbitrary and illegal and is calling for their immediate release. Writer Peter Fabricius is with us. He's working that story. And first of all, Peter, can you give me a little more detail on this UN call?
Well, they were approached, obviously, by the family of Frederick Potgieter and Peter Huxham. And their criteria are basically that, the case against these people, you know, just doesn't stand up, you know. So if they deem that somebody has been imprisoned or detained or lost their personal liberty, as they put it, for no good cause, then that to them is an arbitrary detention and falls within their purview.
Does a call like this make any real difference, though? Does it carry any weight?
Yeah. That's a good question, because they themselves acknowledge, I think, that they don't have any sanctions. You know, I mean, they can't really punish anybody for an arbitrary detention. I guess the best you can say is that it adds some kind of, you know, weight to the argument for the release of these two guys. I mean, it's a horrible government that and this vice president who they've come up against is, even by Equatorial Guinean standards, a nasty piece of work. So whether they will care a damn about what this group has said is hard to say. It is a government that cares about its reputation to a degree. It's been trying to rehabilitate it for years. So It might help a bit, yeah.
Peter, the families believe that the arrests were in fact retaliation due to the actions taken against the seizure of properties of this man that you're talking about, this vice president. Is there evidence or indication to support this belief?
You know, I don't think you're going to find evidence to that to really back it up in a sort of legal sense. The circumstantial evidence, I guess you could say, is quite strong, because it happened. The arrests of these guys happened within days of the seizure of the properties and the yacht had been before. Just forgetting now the sequence. Mm. So, you know, when you look at that, it does look pretty, you know, a pretty convincing kind of argument. But it's not. I don't think you could. How would you? You know, it'd be very difficult to prove that in a court of law, I guess.
Peter, just remind our audience again what the pair were doing there and what the specific charges that were brought against them.
Yeah, they were working for an international oil company, and they were providing, I think, some sort of expert. They're engineers, you know, by profession, providing some sort of expert technical advice to this company. I mean, Equatorial Guinea has fabulous oil reserves, which is made it a terrifically expensive country, which is why the vice president's son can buy villas in Cape Town and, you know, yachts and so on. And they were charged with drug dealing, you know. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous charges because, for example, the prosecution claimed, and the court, which is obviously completely biased, accepted that they'd found drugs in their luggage. And yet when they came, so I don't know who came, but maybe the embassy, our embassy or something, came to collect the luggage, it was still locked with a combination. So obviously the cops hadn't even been into the suitcase to find drugs. So it's clearly a trumped up case.
And the response from the South African and UK governments regarding the detention, what have they been saying?
Yeah, they're cautious. I, to be honest, I'm not 100% sure about the UK, but our government did call for their release. And in fact, the now ex Minister of International Relations, Naledi Pandor, visited Equatorial Guinea just a couple of months ago, and they issued a statement to say they'd raised this and there would be engagements. But you know, since then, that kind of file has gone very silent. So one imagines that there's been no progress. You know, and I actually think, I don't know, this might be your next question, that it would probably take the return of those villas to persuade this vice president, because he's an incredibly greedy, you know, materialistic kind of person. That would be very difficult to achieve, because those properties were seized in terms of a court order to settle a similar claim against, you know, by another South African who had been detained illegally. So I don't know where that leaves the South African government, to be honest.
Peter, what have you been able to determine about the conditions in which the two are being held?
Yeah, I don't think great, because those prisons are not great, but they seem to be okay. I mean, they don't seem to be in any sort of imminent danger. But, you know, the prison conditions in that country are pretty dire at the best of times. You know?
And you've obviously been in touch with the families, not coping well with their detention, I imagine.
No, they're not. It's been very traumatic. They seem to be quite uplifted by this UN working group's decision. They're hoping that that'll give some impetus, you know, to the effort to release them. And you would have seen probably also that they submitted a kind of petition to the Pan-African Parliament last week. And not that that's a very potent body either, but, you know, there's been a big effort to try to draw attention to the case. Whether that will prevail, it seems to me that the AU might be the way to go, because the AU treats that government with a certain amount of deference, largely because it pays for quite a lot of things in the AU, and that's the problem. You know, it holds like summits in that country and so on of the AU, and pays for everybody to fly there. I mean, they've got more money than they know what to do with, and they throw it around. You know?
I'm going to leave it there, Peter. Fabricius, thank you very much indeed. Appreciate your time as always. And just before I leave you, on our last online poll, the Gauteng coalition stalemate, I asked you yesterday if it could be resolved, if it was hubris as far as the players were concerned. 40% of our respondents saying that they didn't see any resolution anytime soon. Well, there has been a resolution. Effectively, we have a minority government here in Gauteng. That descriptor, though, if you were listening to the program, carefully denied by the Gauteng Premier, Panyaza Lesufi. Nonetheless, let's go with a minority government. And do you think it's workable? Not at all. Or that the parties must try harder? Panyaza Lesufi also telling me the door is still open for talks with the Democratic Alliance. If you have a view on that, you can participate in the poll either on our X or LinkedIn pages. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.